This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 21st, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the U.S. announces new sanctions against North Korea ahead of joint military exercises in the region.
Today, I'm announcing a series of measures to increase our ability to prevent North Korea's proliferation.
We'll take a look at the black USDA employee fired this week after right-wing media accused her of racism. And disability rights activists push for more funding as the 20-year anniversary of the landmark legislation approaches. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, President Obama signed historic financial reform legislation into law.
This is the central lesson, not only of this crisis, but of our history. Ultimately, there's no dividing line between Main Street and Wall Street. We rise or fall together as one nation. So these reforms will help lift our economy and lead all of us to a stronger, more prosperous future.
The bill is considered the largest overhaul of the financial system since the Great Depression. It creates a consumer protection agency, gives government more control over failing financial firms, and limits the types of risks firms can take.
Our financial system only works. Our market is only free when there are clear rules and basic safeguards that prevent abuse, that check excess, that ensure that it is more profitable to play by the rules than to game the system.
Another provision requires U.S. companies to ensure they are not using raw mineral materials sourced in the Congo, where sexual violence is an epidemic. The Obama administration has also announced intentions to reduce greenhouse gas pollution by federal agencies by 13% in the next decade. The reduction covers indirect sources of pollution like commuting and other travel. This expands on an executive order issued in October 2009 that requires the government to be a leader in creating a green economy. The federal government is the largest single consumer of energy in the country. The Oakland City Council has voted to permit 4 industrial-scale marijuana farms to sell cannabis to medical marijuana dispensaries. It's a move some say will make Oakland the Silicon Valley of marijuana, while others say it will corporatize a grassroots industry built by the counterculture. FSRN's Kelia Ramirez has the story.
The city will begin issuing permits in January for 4 industrial farms that would have no size limit. Among other things, the regulations will require applicants to pay a $211,000 annual permit fee that will be used to hire a regulatory staff to oversee compliance. Proponents of taxing and regulating marijuana see industrial farming as creating jobs and tax revenues for the cash-strapped city. But Elizabeth Francis, a longtime medical marijuana patient and activist, calls the Oakland decision an abomination.
No other medication in the state of California is allowed to be taxed. So if these people are truly in favor of medical marijuana, why do they support this huge tax? That's just certainly without precedent.
Small and medium-sized growers, including patient collectives, say this measure will push them out of an industry that they risked arrest to build. California will vote this November on Proposition 19, which would legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Kelly Ramirez, FSRN, Oakland.
China's official estimates of the scope of an oil spill caused by a pipeline explosion last weekend have increased significantly. Now authorities say the oil has spread to cover 170 square miles of ocean near the port city of Dalian on the Yellow Sea. The Guardian reports 800 fishing vessels are assisting in the cleanup and one person has drowned. A long-running hunger strike in Mexico City protesting the closing of a state utility has taken a dramatic turn as 2 strike participants have developed medical complications. FSRN's Shannon Young has more.
Cayetano Cabrera and Miguel Ángel Ibarra have been on hunger strike since late April in protest of a presidential decree which dissolved the state-owned electrical company that served Mexico City and the surrounding area. A doctor who has been monitoring the health of the group of 15 hunger strikers warns that two men are currently at risk of heart failure. Cabrera has lost 46 pounds and Ibarra has lost 55 pounds. The protesters are calling on the federal government to reinstate the 44,000 workers who lost their jobs overnight when President Felipe Calderon dissolved the public utility and sent police to occupy the company's facilities. The government has not officially responded. Unions across Mexico criticized the move, and some saw it as a decisive test case for public sector labor rights. The closure of the utility effectively signaled the end of the country's oldest labor organization, the Mexican Electricians Union, which had a long history of supporting leftist causes. Mexico's Supreme Court recently upheld the constitutionality of the presidential decree that dissolved the power company and, by extension, ended official recognition of the union. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
And finally, Israel will restrict the use of white phosphorus weapons, according to a report the country's foreign ministry sent to the UN. The report is the result of an internal investigation into allegations of illegal tactics used during the war in Gaza. It states the Israeli Defense Forces are working on a clear doctrine and permanent restrictions on the use of the weapons, which is banned from being used near civilians by international law. Israel says it has opened 47 criminal investigations and is currently prosecuting 4 military personnel related to incidents during the war. But officials maintain that it did not violate any international laws of engagement. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced new sanctions against North Korea. The news came during a visit to the border between South and North Korea.
Today, I'm announcing a series of measures to increase our ability to prevent North Korea's proliferation, to halt their illicit activities that help fund their weapons programs, and to discourage further provocative actions.
Clinton made the visit with Defense Secretary Robert Gates. This also comes ahead of an increase in military exercises set to begin this weekend. Tensions in the region have been high since the torpedo sinking of a South Korean ship called the Cheonan that killed 46 sailors in March. For more, we're joined by Christine Ann. She's a policy analyst with the Los Angeles-based Korea Policy Institute. She's addressed the United Nations, U.S. Congress, and the South Korean National Human Rights Commission on U.S.-Korea relations, trade, and militarization. She's also part of the national campaign to end the Korea War. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks, Dorian.
North Korea is already one of the most isolated countries in the world. There are already sanctions imposed by the U.S. and other countries on the regime. What's new about these sanctions announced today?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think that they could add any more sanctions against North Korea. I mean, they have limited the export of goods and services. They've prohibited any foreign aid and agricultural sales. They've really banned export, import, bank funding, medicine, food, fertilizer. The whole country's economy has been essentially strangled by the sanctions that have been in place for decades. So I think what it is more of a provocation. As most of us know, North Korea's leader is not well, and I think that there is, given the you know, ongoing financial crisis in North Korea, that you know it's a sign of a provocative sort of drumbeat for war.
As you mentioned, Clinton made the visit to the DMZ with Secretary Gates. It was her first visit there. And during that, when she mentioned these new sanctions, which, as you point out, sanctions have been imposed on North Korea for decades without much effect. Now, she said these new sanctions would target the leaders of North Korea. She made it a point to say it would not further punish the people. Of course, many reports about the people, how hunger is a persistent problem, access to basic, very basic medical services is an issue. What could be the effect of these sanctions on regular North Koreans?
Well, I think that it's completely wrong to say that the sanctions have not impacted the people. I mean, how can you divorce when you have sanctions that don't allow seed, fertilizer? Even South Korea has been barred from, South Korean humanitarian aid groups have been barred from sending humanitarian aid into North Korea, so that would be considered sort of dual use items. Computers, I mean, these are things that all, like, you know, help an economy function, a society develop. And to actually say that it does not impact the people is completely farce. When I saw that picture on the New York Times of Clinton and Gates in Panmunjom at the DMC, I've been in that building before when I visited North Korea. And actually, the sign from North Korea projected towards South Korea at the DMZ, it says Chaju Tongil, which means reunification on our terms. And the U.S. still has 28,000 troops. We expend $1.2 billion annually on maintaining about 85 military bases and installations. We participate annually with South Korea in these military exercises, and now we have extended U.S. control. This is U.S. control in 2010 over South Korea's military. This is it's an absurd situation.
This year is the 60th anniversary of the Korean War, a war that is technically still ongoing. The larger issue here is one of permanent peace. The six-party talks in 2005 called for direct parties to negotiate a permanent peace. Where does that stand today?
It stands in a complete standstill. It has not gone anywhere. So we have to be the bigger people here. And the U.S., which divided the Korean Peninsula, you know, two generals took a page from the National Geographic and they drew a line, which is became the 38th parallel. Was that meant to be permanent? I don't think so. Is Korea a country that has shared for centuries the same language, the same food, families? Yes. And so I think we have to say enough is enough. 60 years of war is enough. We need to finally end this war. We need to replace the temporary armistice, which was signed in 1953 with a permanent peace treaty. And I hope that listeners of FSRN understand that it's important to look at the big picture, the long history, and to realize that it is time now to end this Korean War, that it's having impacts on a daily basis on Korean people, not just on the peninsula, but right here and throughout the diaspora.
Christine An is a policy analyst with the Korea Policy Institute. She joined us to talk about new sanctions in North Korea and a path towards permanent peace in the region. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dorian.
The conservative news media's sharp criticism of a Black Agriculture Department employee leads to a quick firing. If you feel like you've heard a similar story before, you have. It happened to Green Jobs Advisor Van Jones last fall. And this week, it happened to the USDA's Shirley Sherrod. But now, more has come out in the case, causing some to question the administration's rapid action. Tanya Snyder reports.
It all starts with a controversy over the NAACP's resolution condemning racism within the Tea Party movement. Conservative media activist Andrew Breitbart went on the warpath, looking for evidence of racism within the ranks of the NAACP itself. And he thought he found it in a speech given by USDA official Shirley Sherrod at an NAACP conference in March. In the speech, Sherrod said she hadn't given the full force of her effort to a white farmer who was being foreclosed on since so many Black farmers were struggling.
Everything that I did working with him helped me to see that it wasn't about race. It's about those who have and those who don't.
Sherrod explained to CNN that she tells that story to show how she'd gotten beyond race. The incident took place 24 years ago when she was working for a nonprofit, decades before taking over as rural development director for the USDA in Georgia. Breitbart posted a severely edited version of the video. Fox News picked up on it, and within hours, the White House was demanding her resignation.
They harassed me as I was driving back to the state office from West Point, Georgia yesterday. I had at least three calls telling me the White House wanted me to resign. And the last one asked me to pull over to the side of the road and do it.
And why did they demand this? Sherrod told CNN what they told her.
Because you are going to be on Glenn Beck tonight.
The NAACP initially condemned Sherrod's actions as well, based on the Fox News video, but quickly recanted, saying they'd been snookered and they are now helping her clear her name. Michael Fauntroy is a professor of public policy at George Mason University.
Pressure is building on the administration to bring Sherrod back to her previous position. But at some level, the toothpaste is already out of the tube. The White House has continued a pattern of being weak on the question of race, and I don't think that bringing her back would necessarily fix that.
Fauntroy says President Obama hasn't shown any inclination to have an open dialogue about race. Others agree, saying 18 months after the election of the first black president, the conversation about race in this country is more distorted than before. Mark Potok investigates hate groups for the Southern Poverty Law Center.
President Clinton did a better job of trying to discuss race openly in this country than, in fact, Barack Obama has done. And the Obama administration is absolutely terrified of alienating large numbers of white people.
And that's been the point of attack for conservative groups and media pundits. By trying to show evidence of anti-white racism by members of the administration, they promote fears that the federal government is an instrument of oppression against white people. That's what Peter Montgomery says. He monitors the right-wing political movement for People for the American Way.
Since even before the election of Barack Obama, and certainly since then, the political right has used every strategy they have to try to fan the flames of racial resentment, a sort of a really crass strategy to try to win back some of the white working class voters that they lost to President Obama.
Conservatives on Fox News and elsewhere said Green Job Czar Van Jones was a black radical and a conspiracy theorist, and he was forced to resign. Then they hit the roof over a Homeland Security report on the rise of right-wing extremism, which the administration then retracted. They turned race-based voter intimidation on its head and accused Acorn of intimidating white voters, charges which Obama rejected, but he then put as much distance between himself and Acorn as he could. Before Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation to the Supreme Court, conservatives accused her of racism because of her famous Wise Latina remark, but the administration stood by her. Michael Fauntroy says that one was easy.
Well, the difference was he knew he had the votes to win, and there was never any question that Sonia Sotomayor was going to be confirmed. But these other two people were lower-level employees who could be thrown under the bus and not be pretty much worried about.
Even Glenn Beck has said Sherrod shouldn't have been fired. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs formally apologized to Sherrod in his press briefing Wednesday. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, whose decision it was to fire her, has now said he's reviewing the decision. Sherrod first indicated she wasn't even sure she'd take the job back if she couldn't be assured she'd be treated fairly, but she seemed convinced by entreaties by the NAACP to continue her important work if given the chance. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, Washington.
The federal government's oil disaster leader says BP can go ahead with a new method to try to permanently seal the damaged well. Retired Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen said the static kill procedure would force mud into the well and push the oil back down into the reservoir. Allen said officials are continuing to monitor pressure within the well to determine if such a procedure is possible. Leaks have been discovered even as far away as nearly 2 miles at another production site, but Allen said that authorities did not consider them consequential. Allen also said a weather system over the Caribbean could threaten work if it worsens in the next few days. Meanwhile, in Washington, the House passed two bills in response to the BP oil disaster, one that would invest in technologies to ensure gas and oil drilling safety. The other, sponsored by California Representative Lynn Woolsey, would fund research and development to prevent and clean up oil spills. Woolsey said California's experiences with an oil spill 4 decades ago is evidence more money is needed for drilling safety research.
Madam Speaker, if we learned anything from the Costco Busan spill, it was that we need to strengthen coordination and leadership of oil spill response research and development. And everything that we learned from the BP Gulf of Mexico disaster magnifies my concerns.
Also on Capitol Hill today, Kenneth Feinberg testified for the second time this week about the claims process for those affected by the BP oil disaster. Before the House Judiciary Committee, he emphasized the independent nature of his position.
Under the arrangement entered into between the administration and BP, I am designing and administering an independent facility. I am beholden to neither the administration nor BP. I'm really beholden to the people who live in the Gulf and who are in desperate straits and seek financial assistance from this facility.
Feinberg said the transition of claims from BP to this independent facility will go through in August. He credited BP with paying out some $200 million in claims, but said the independent facility will be better, quicker, and more efficient. Next Monday is the 20th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and today activists gathered outside the U.S. Capitol to mark this significant milestone. While they are celebrating achievements, the activists are also urging Congress to pass stalled funding for states. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
As the hot sun beat down on Washington, D.C., a couple hundred people, most disabled and many in wheelchairs, sought shade as they listened to speakers praise the Americans with Disabilities Act.
The ADA has freed so much of us.
The ADA, which passed during George H.W. Bush's presidency, enabled accessibility by building things like ramps and soft street curbs. But in addition to celebrating the past, these disability activists had something more immediate on their mind, government support. And their battle is caught up in the political fight being waged in the building serving as the backdrop of their rally, the U.S. Capitol. It has to do with Medicaid funding for states, also known as FMAP.
So that's another area that we are here to talk to our senators and congressmen about.
Many people with disabilities receive health care through Medicaid. But states are on the verge of cutting their Medicaid funding due to budget shortfalls unless Congress acts again. Congress already increased aid to the states in the stimulus, but that assistance is expected to run out in December. And like many other things, the funding is stuck in the Senate because Republicans are opposed amid concerns of the national deficit. Republican Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho spoke at the disability rally in support of rights and resources. But he told FSRN after his speech that Medicaid assistance needs to be paid for.
Well, I personally believe that all of Congress's spending right now needs to be offset, and that is going to be one of the battles, but it's achievable.
Crapo says the new executive director of the National Council on Independent Living, one of the largest disability rights groups, is from his home state and has been on his case about state Medicaid funding.
He's on the spot all the time, and he's been very aggressive in advocating for this.
But Crapo says it needs to be paid for.
Congress needs to do just what all of the rest of Americans are doing in their own personal and family and their small business budgets, and that is tightening our belt and making things fit.
If states don't receive help, they will tighten their belt. And layoffs are likely, and services, including Medicaid, are likely to be cut. Large states like California and New York could lose billions of dollars. House Democrat Jan Schakowsky of Illinois, whose state is slotted to add $750 million to the state deficit if they don't receive the funding, said the money is crucial for the states and for the disability community.
This mania about deficit cutting right now is dangerous. It's dangerous to people's lives, and it's also dangerous to economic recovery.
Medicaid funding was included in the bill to extend unemployment benefits, but Republican objections resulted in the state aid being dropped from the bill. Democrats hope to pass Medicaid assistance by August. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
A group of African-American employees of Southern California Edison have filed a class action lawsuit against the company, claiming racial discrimination in pay, advancement, and harassment. The suit alleges Edison has refused to incorporate previous federal consent decrees in 1974 and 1994 in order to change a racist management culture. FSRN's Dan Fritz has the story.
In front of the Los Angeles County Courthouse, attorney Charles Matthews and African-American employees of Southern California Edison told reporters that a racist mindset persists in Edison management, despite lawsuits and consent decrees going back to the 70s.
They were supposed to implement something called a career development program. The purpose was to assure equal employment opportunities, including career advancement opportunities for African Americans in a manner consistent with the goals and purposes of this decree and for all other employees. And that was never done. It was just not implemented. And to the extent that they claim that it was done, look at the results. The employee population, African American population, has shrunk by approximately 40% since the ink was dry on this thing.
The current lawsuit also includes some African Americans who applied and were denied jobs. Matthews claims his clients still encounter a glass ceiling that was identified in a 1974 lawsuit, which prevents them from getting promotions, bonuses, and equal pay, as well as performance appraisals.
I mean, it may be an economic decision on Edison's part, or it may be just racial bias at the top levels of this company that is seeping on down.
Security specialist Joan Greer is one of the named plaintiffs who claims she was harassed after a less competent white employee was promoted to be her supervisor.
If I asked for a vacation day off, he would say I have to give him like 20 days notice when the actual rule was like 5 days, if at all existent, because they didn't use it anymore. If I called in sick, I would get harassed for that, even if I had a doctor's excuse.
In addition to claims of harassment and a glass ceiling, the plaintiffs say a mindset of discrimination pervades the company management. Michael Hoskins, who has worked in corporate security for Southern California Edison for over 20 years, says company officials would make racially insensitive remarks in front of employees.
Our former director in security, former FBI agent, discussed in our staff meeting that we work for the Grand Dragons, and he was alluding to the executives on the fourth floor of Southern California Edison. This would kind of spearheaded this whole discrimination to file a class action because of these kind of statements. Well, Grand Dragons associated with the Ku Klux Klan.
It sounds ridiculous, but 26 people heard him do it, and he did it twice. That's the mindset.
Matthew says his clients want Edison to fix the problem and pay civil penalties.
As to a specific amount, no, I can't give you one, but it should be an amount that stings this company and hurts them, because it's the only way this company and other companies get the message that there is not economic profit in being a racist organization.
An Edison spokesperson would not comment on the pending litigation. Dan Fritz, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Before we end, a correction. On Tuesday, we mistakenly reported that legislation to extend unemployment insurance had passed in the Senate. In fact, the Senate did vote to invoke cloture, which overcomes the Republican filibuster, but that's not quite the same as passage. Final passage is expected soon. And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Today's technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Scott Pham and Antonio Ortiz. Our intern is Neela Smith-Dorfman. FSRN is a worker-run collective. Major funding comes from the Pacifica Foundation, community radio stations nationwide, and individual donors. You can visit us online at FSRN.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at FSRN.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.